This is KDNK, Carbondale Community Access Radio, Glenwood Springs, Carbondale, the Roaring Fork Valley, and beyond. It is 4 o'clock. I'm Kathleen Shannon. Since the killing of George Floyd on May 25th, protests across the nation have spurred conversations about police brutality. Some Minneapolis City Council members are working to dismantle the police department, and the mayor of Los Angeles is canceling planned budget increases for the city's department. Policing looks different in small rural communities than it does in large urban areas. But how exactly? Last week, I spoke to Carbondale Police Chief Gene Schilling and his soon-to-be replacement, Lieutenant Kirk Wilson, about the police department in Carbondale, its past, and its future. You can find an official letter to the community from Lieutenant Wilson on the department's Facebook page, in which he plans a community policing academy. Stick around for parts of our conversation throughout the next hour. The first voice you'll hear is Chief Schilling's.
I've been talking to some people in light of current events, and we all kind of realized we don't really know that much about how local police operates. I've only lived here for 2 years, so that's probably one of the reasons. But even people I know who've lived here longer are kind of like, you know, certainly the role of the police across the country right now is sort of like being just investigated a little more. Mm-hmm. And people aren't really sure what to think. And we're in a strange place here in this little mountain community. It's totally different than living in a big city or whatever it is. So I kind of just wanted to talk, generally speaking, about policing in this town. And I know you've been here for a long time. How long have you been working in the Carbondale Police?
This is my 37th year.
Yeah, so you've seen a lot of changes,
yeah.
I imagine.
See, I grew up here. Not only have I been here a long time as the police chief and the police officer, but I've been here a long time. I graduated from high school here, and so
cool.
I've seen a ton of change.
Yeah, I think that will actually be an interesting perspective. First off, I saw your post of your letter on Facebook.
Yeah.
I was curious, do you know when the Community Policing Academy will be happening yet?
We were making a very valiant attempt at trying to sit down just this morning, and then, no. My goal is sooner as opposed to later,
mm-hmm.
hopefully before the end of the year. I would hate to say, I'd hate to give you a deadline and then something stalls it. But I think that's the next conversation is before the end of the day is try to start mapping some things out.
So I kind of want to hop into like police philosophy, which is something I've been reading a lot about over the last week. And I know, especially just over time, police philosophies across the country have changed. But I also know people get trained differently in different places in different ways. And it doesn't necessarily seem to be like a centralized methodology of training. So is there a certain philosophy that this department really focuses on and sticks to?
We'll answer together, but he did a lot of ride-alongs and investigating into the department before he applied to be the chief of police. So he has some outside visions, and I have visions from inside. Our big thing here is one of the philosophies are, you know, education versus citation is the words I use. And citation can mean a traffic ticket or citation can mean an arrest. So we try as much as we can to not get people in the system. You know, we would rather someone learns from whatever it is and not get arrested. Well, along those lines, there's other things that you don't have any choice in. Domestic violence, you don't have a choice. Some serious crimes, you don't have a choice. But our philosophy and our training that we do of officers here is that, you know, force is the last option. Try and not use force. And then you have escalation. You know, they talk about chokeholds. Well, we don't allow chokeholds, but there are in our officer training that we do for arrest control, there are things that you might have around that part of the body, but we don't use chokeholds. And chokeholds, you know, cut the air supply away. And they're very serious. And if you get to a point where you might have to use something that's considered a chokehold, you're looking at deadly force. When I was young in my career, when I'd been here about 3 or 4 years, we worked by ourselves. We didn't have backup close. So basically, you're on your own. I had a guy at the Black Nugget that was going in there and being very racially inappropriate with a bunch of Latino workers from the coal mine in there when I got called and they wanted him removed. I asked him to leave. I probably talked to him for half an hour. And finally he said, you know, I'm staying here. I'm not leaving. I'm going to do whatever I want to do. And I said, well, okay, you're under arrest. Well, the fight was on. And I ended up doing a carotid hold on him. And my next option at that point, and things have changed a lot since then, I want to say, was to shoot him. So that saved his life and, in my belief, saved a lot of trauma for me because I don't want to have to shoot anybody.
Right. You mean by doing the hold and not having to shoot him?
Okay. So what happened was, you know, the carotid hold, what it does is it cuts off blood to the head and it makes you pass out. The procedure after that is you call an ambulance and they get medical care, you know, and that's, I followed the procedure we had at that time. So I don't, you know, like we don't do chokeholds, which is oxygen. And the idea in Minneapolis was where the guy had his knee on the neck. Well, that does the carotid stuff. And you don't want to do that very long because that's blood to the brain. So, you know, as soon as the person is not resisting, if that's the word you want to use, you want to make sure they get immediate medical care to make sure everything's going okay. But we don't want to have to do that. Now you have other options. Back then we didn't have tasers. You know, now you have tasers. You know, you have other use of force options. You know, you see in the news rubber bullets, tear gas, a bunch of things. We have none of that, you know. That's not a way that we would be performing some type of control mm-hmm. on people that are doing rioting or whatever else it may be. And in this area, you know, we all share officers because none of us have enough to deal with large crowds. When we do Mountain Fair, when Glenwood does Strawberry Days, you know, we have to get officers from other agencies to come and try and be part of that and help. We do de-escalation training. We do that monthly, and then we have once or twice a year that we have a real in-depth one. We do arrest control. We do arrest control throughout the year. You know, our policies follow guidelines, so it's called Lexapol, which is kind of a nationwide policy of how law enforcement agencies are supposed to perform. My guess was in Minneapolis, and, you know, I don't want to throw somebody under the bus, but they probably had a policy that may have prohibited that. They definitely should have had a policy that required other officers to intervene, and they also probably have a policy that officers are supposed to report. A lot of those things are Colorado law. You have a duty to report under Colorado law. If you don't intervene when you see someone using excessive force, you can lose your certification as a police officer. You know, so I think some law enforcement entities get a culture within them that those things are okay. And you're not going to see that culture here. If we have an officer that, and I'll use the word that's out of line, we're going to know. The guy back there had 18 complaints against him for different things. Well, you aren't going to get an officer here with 18 complaints. The other part of my philosophy, and Kirk's going to carry this on, I'm sure, is that we don't police the community. The police chooses how we police the community. And that's a totally different, you know, people come in and say, well, this is how I'm going to do the job. Well, that doesn't work. You know, the people are the ones that tell us how they want us to police the community. And we have to work with them to do that. One of the reasons a lot of people don't know a lot about how we do stuff in our policies is because there's no reason, because we're out there doing a good job all the time. Now that it's a nationwide issue, we get emails and you're here and other people wanting to know how those things work. One of the things that we're going to do because of this, is Kirk's going to develop a frequently asked questions things to put on her website to help people get the answers to those questions. Mm-hmm. But I think the training and the culture of the department is, it's a life and death situation, last resort, just like a carotid hold maybe, or whatever else might be out there. Mm-hmm. And that's the way the culture has to be, and that's the way the training of your department has to be, and that has to be the culture that the town accepts, is that you're doing everything you can to serve them, because that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to be here for you, to protect you, and make sure everything's safe. And that's whoever you is. Anybody we come in contact is, that's our job.
Mm-hmm. This is something I think both of you could speak to. And you've been here long enough to see huge changes in the population, including just size.
Yes.
And I think racial makeup.
Diversity,
probably,
yes.
As well. And you were coming from Rifle. I actually don't, mm-hmm. I didn't get to look into the history of your career so far, but have you spent the whole time in Rifle?
The whole time? Well, sorry, I was a transplant from Phoenix, Arizona.
Okay.
So I came up to Rifle in 2002, mm-hmm. and this is day five for me.
Right. Cool. So, and Rifle has, I think, a very different feel than up here in some ways, but
sure.
A lot of people work up here, live down there. It's all connected. Mm-hmm. I'm curious what changes you've seen over time in policing, like what has needed to change, what has changed as the population has changed, and kind of related to that, I'm curious to know what your... What differences and similarities you see between Rifle and here,
sure.
and how your policing may change according to that.
So I started at the police department in 1983. There were 6 officers. Our population was about 600 people. I called, you know, they have the buzzword out there, community policing. Well, I said that was just a buzzword they picked up. We did what I called rural policing. And rural policing has always been community policing. You know, at that point in time, you knew everybody in town. When you went on a call, they said you're going over to Fred's you're going down over to Fred's house. And you knew who Fred was. You know, today, the officers need name, address, phone number, because with the increase in population, you don't know everybody. So now the people we know are either... And this kind of goes along to the bad police officer thing. The people you know are the people you have trouble with all the time. It's just like if you have an officer that's getting in trouble, the town, it spreads like wildfire. The opposite is true, or the same is true, when you have a resident that causes problems all the time, all the community know who that person is. But you've got either got A, the ones that are kind of the problem children, and you got the other end of the spectrum, the ones that we have a lot of positive contact with. And then the ones in the middle a lot of times kind of get lost. You know, you don't know them like in the days when there was only 600 people. I have a really weird memory thing for numbers. In the old days when there wasn't that many people here, the officers could come up to me and ask me, who owned this car? This is what a car looks like. What's the license plate and who owns it? And I could tell them. Or they could do just the opposite. This is a license plate we got off a car. Somebody recorded it. What's it look like and who owns it? And I could tell them. Today, with 7,000 residents, and I'm getting old, my brain doesn't have that much room anymore. But I still know a lot of them. Not all officers can do that. It's a very weird gift that I have, that I'm able to do that. But you know, today, I know some, but it's not like back then. I could almost tell you almost everybody's license plate in town and what kind of car they drove. So in that area, it's changed a lot. Today we have, in my opinion, a lot more people that feel they're entitled. In the old days, the police were respected. A lot of people no longer have respect for the police. You know, that causes issues. We also have a lot more tools today. So to me, they're always trying to do less lethal stuff so that we don't have to get to that point of serious bodily injury. But with more people today, you know, there's a lot of people that don't have contact with the police that like you said, don't know what we do. So in a way, that's kind of, to me, a negative, because that's where we want to be. We're involved in a lot of community stuff. You know, we have officers that, officers and staff that go to the Valley Settlement Project about once every month or so and answer questions and teach classes. The Latino community culturally is scared of the police because the culture they come from, the police are the bad guys. So that's one of the areas we try to work to break that barrier down, to tell them that, you know, you're valued by us and we want you to trust us. You know, several years ago, not a long, long time ago, when we first started having that cultural diverse population come in, it was hard for people to call us. We had a lot of instances of domestic violence. We made videos back then and other things that we used to try and educate them that this is not okay and we're okay to be trusted. In a way, this is kind of like a mini police academy that we do through the Valley Settlement Project with non-English speaking as a primary language of people. You know, we talk about traffic stops and what you do on traffic stops. We talk about domestic violence situations. We talk about, you know, things like getting your driver's license, and just a lot of things like that. And we have quite a few people that attend those. And so that's one of the ways we're trying to build that relationship. We attend a lot of the special events. You know, First Friday is a good place to be out there on foot and bike patrol. We have electric bikes and we encourage foot and bike patrol because when you're in a car, it's really hard to make, you know, contact with someone unless you stop and roll down the window. Otherwise, it's just so, you know, you just drive by. It's changed. We now have River Valley Ranch, and in our policing a little bit, it's changed because a lot of the residents over there are great, but now we have second homes over there that a lot of times we don't have people in. And then the other part of it is some of those people are fairly well off and feel that because of their status, they deserve more service from us than people in other areas. And I'm the type of guy is, you know, you're all the same. Doesn't matter racially, socially, economically, however it is, we deserve to give the same service to everyone here, no matter what. Whether that person is on welfare or whether that person has $1 billion in the bank. If there's an issue you have, you get the same service. You know, it needs to be the same for everyone.
Yeah. I'm interested in the racial makeup of the force here, the department. And does everyone need to be able to speak Spanish?
Well, the short answer is no, they do not. I do not speak Spanish. And to back up on that, because I want to end, we were the first agency in the Valley that had bilingual officers. At one point in time, we had 5 Spanish-speaking officers on our force. Over the years, other places stole them and they retired, so we were down to just a few. And I would say we have some that are very Spanish literate, and we have some that are Spanish literate, but they couldn't write Spanish and other things. Because we've had some Spanish immersion training that we've done for officers. We've had 2 sessions of that because we believe it's very important. And so most of the officers can get by on basic Spanish stuff, but they aren't really that literate. So if you take total staff, we're probably about half. One of my other priorities in that area is, as much as I can, hire people that are local. So we have Isabel Anna Sheha, Ben and Paul, who all graduated, who went to school here or lived here and in the area for a significant amount of time. Paul was in Glenwood, the other four were here, so they all came from here. David actually grew up in Montrose, which the time he grew up was kind of a small community, because if you can get them from the small communities, that's real good. Quinn, who is our newest hire, actually grew up in Glenwood. And so a lot of times when you get them from the agency like this, or you get them from your town, they know how we've been and they know how we expect them to treat the people that they take care of out there.
Great. And I think that segues probably well into sort of,
well, first of all, do you think there's a difference in the policies around use of force in the rifle department and the Carbondale department?
The policies, from what I've read, are almost verbatim, if not verbatim. They're all generated from the same company, Lexapol, that goes ahead and vets a lot of those policies. And agencies are able to contact Lexapol and say, we want to do this with this policy or that. So it's day five for me.
Right. Yeah.
So I haven't gotten through them all, but on day one, obviously walking in here Monday, one of the first things was, let's go through the use of force policy. Let's make sure there's nothing out of line, outdated. It's very up to date. It's a very progressive policy, for sure. And I feel very comfortable with it.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of big differences or challenges do you foresee in your time here, just changing communities a little bit, or do you expect it to be pretty similar?
So I'm not going to change. I'm a younger Gene. So coming from rifle, I knew everyone. And I was the guy that was stopping and saying hello to people along the side of the road or out walking, or whenever I was out and about, I was the guy that people approached. My wife didn't like me to go into City Market if we were in a hurry, because just to get a gallon of milk, it would take me 30, 45 minutes just to make it to the checkout line. I could say from day one, right along with Chief Schilling, I thought I knew people. This man knows everyone. And not only does he know everyone, he knows the family trees. He can say, well, their son is over here, and oh, you're gonna wanna go talk to them for this. His knowledge, his personal mind Rolodex is incredible. And our philosophies are very, very much alike. So people are people, and they deserve the utmost respect. And this is an agency that definitely recognizes that. So you have a law enforcement agency that, when asking when was the last use of force, when the last time an officer used force, no one here could recall the last incident.
And I would add significant force to that.
Yes,
know, because like 3 weeks ago or whatever, I had to tackle a lady on the side of 82. And even I had to do use of force, but it was a lady that was having a mental health breakdown. But, it's still a use of force incident. And even me as the chief, I had to do a use of force report. And that use of force report has to be reviewed by someone to make sure that's appropriate. So that's a big key is, that's one of the things they want. Every use of force is reported. Well, that's our policy. It's reported, and someone has to use it, and someone has to say, is there something we could have done better or different?
Yeah. Is there anything else you wanted to?
No, I was just going to say this. So we're a department that is not as busy as other agencies up and down the valley. We don't have the issues that a lot of these agencies have. So we have a lot more time to dedicate to individual calls. So if something is going on, it affords our officers a tremendous amount of time to, hey, sit down, let's talk, let's figure this out. The philosophy here is talk somebody into handcuffs. If we have to make an arrest, we're gonna talk people into handcuffs. Hey, look, if you don't comply with this, then I have to put my hands on you. I don't wanna do that. I might get hurt, you might get hurt. Nobody wants to be involved in those types of situations. Is there anything we can do here? And our officers are really good at that. The de-escalation training here is significant. And I think I would say from the outside coming in, that was one thing that attracted me to coming here is just the way things are. It's a very accepting, inclusive, polite and kind community. You know, even our protests are very different from what you see across the country. You see officers that are, we're not happy with what happened. That's not my profession. That's not a reflection of me. And so just, it's a different feel in the community. The community makeups are similar, you know, but overall, I'm gonna be the same guy. Hopefully, when I retire from here, after a 30-plus year career, people are gonna say, "Hey, Kirk knew everybody, and if he didn't, that was a rarity." And that's my goal. I want to be a clearinghouse for our community. I want the police department to be a location that if someone is in doubt, if someone isn't sure about how to get help, for whatever the case may be, I want them to feel comfortable calling us or coming in and saying, "This is going on, what do I do?" Mm-hmm. That's my goal.
Cool.
And along that line, mm-hmm. I like to throw this out there just so you know. One of my philosophies for my staff has always been, I don't care what the problem is, try and solve it. You know, if it's somebody, the trash dumpster people aren't picking up the trash dumpster, it's not a police problem. It's somebody else's. But don't say, "It's not my problem," because it is. If they came to you, it is your problem. You may not be able to solve that problem for them, but you need to make sure that you put them in the direction that they need to go, or call it the direction they need to go and try and solve that. Example, probably 4 or 5 years ago, we had a guy that came in and got a speeding ticket from State Patrol down in the San Luis Valley. Only spoke Spanish. He'd been trying to solve it and had got an arrest warrant because the ticket didn't get paid. And so one of my office staff got on the phone with Alamosa, worked things through to where he could get that taken care of, and eventually he paid it and it was done with. Well, you know, technically, I suppose that's not our job. It's Alamosa for whatever, but solve that. You know, the ditch is running over. I don't want an officer to say to me, "Well, I couldn't get a hold of Public Works and this ditch is running over because it's plugged. You try and unplug it first. And then if you can't unplug it, then you call Public Works and see if you can solve it that way." You know, whatever it is, that's what we want to try and do.